would you say, biblically speaking, now again, we can't point to a verse or whatever, but your understanding of a biblical theology of this, of the scriptures, that a pluralistic, and you can correct and cut and paste whatever, you know, words you want, that a pluralistic liberal society is what the Bible anticipates as the ideal society in the fall?
I wouldn't say ideal. I take out the word ideal. I think living in a fallen society, you're trying to make do with the best you can out of a really bad set of conditions.
Oh boy, fun times on Grace at the Gates. I have a fan favorite, Daryl Hart, DG Hart. Daryl, thanks for coming on again.
Sure, good to see you again, George.
Yes, you might be the guest I've had on the most often at this point.
Huh.
I've had Mel Duncan on quite a bit, but you're going to rival that, I think. And the, well, first of all, happy 250th. Did you enjoy the 4th of July? Did you do anything special?
I did. I spent a week, I go back tomorrow to Boston where we have a summer cottage, but I spent a week in Philadelphia. Came down. We have a place we're going to retire to in a condo that's about 3 blocks from Independence Hall. And so I've been seeing a lot of sights, looking at the crowds, going to museums, and it's been great. It really has. I've had a great time.
Yeah. So, because you wrote a book on Independence Hall, right?
Right. It comes out in September.
Okay. Well, there you go. We'll have to have you on again. So you're actually very prolific in these later years for you. both online and in writing. Yeah, man, 4th of July was amazing. This new house we have in Tallahassee backs up to these parks. I actually have like 30 miles of mountain bike trails, but large city park here in Tallahassee, and all the roads were closed down because this is where our state capitol did their fireworks thing. So we, the family rode our bikes down. We didn't have to deal with crowds or anything. We could just ride right in, but it was amazing. And it just felt good to be an American, to see the level of diversity, but just sort of unity around, the country was good in a normally divisive, type place. So.
Yeah. Was there much soccer, FIFA stuff going on?
I didn't notice that that night, but yeah, that's
because Philadelphia, I guess, is hosting some of it, and there have been displays of big screens for the events at different points in the city. One of those was on Independence Mall, just across the street from Independence Hall, and I haven't followed it at all, but still, lots of people here for that as well.
I haven't followed it either, but I didn't even actually know we were the host until I started seeing it on social media.
They won't tell you we're hosts with Canada and Mexico. It's North America that's the host.
They won't tell you. Yes. It's what I've loved to see, all the videos of like people from other countries, like appreciating stuff in the US, particularly like, you know, pop culture things or whatever, like Bucky's or whatever. Right. The thing it's been great. And at our, the PCA's General Assembly in, Louisville, Kentucky, we were right by this outdoor huge mall that would shut down all the streets. It was like an outdoor mall and they'd have the big screens there. And, I think Mexico was playing, so they had a whole Mexican display, and it's just neat. It's cool.
Yeah.
Well, we are going to be talking, no surprise, we just continue the Christian and country discussion, Christian nationalism discussion. You and I had some private messages about the PCA's report, and I was going to have you on the week before I was leaving for General Assembly, and I had too much to do. I was going away for 12 days. I was away. So we put it on the back burner. And then I think we both had the same feeling, like maybe it's already stale or done, but you reached out to me and you said, no, let's do it. And I enter this with fear and trepidation, Daryl. honestly, go ahead.
No, I listened to your podcast about the report, and I think that was before you went to GA, and you said a few things in there, like the report may have been too lenient on M2K or R2K. And I was curious why you thought that. So I thought that might be worth talking about. Even, you know, trying to understand what M2K or R2K is in relation to the report, and whether some people in the PCA think that the report took a side, maybe not way on one side, but still, if there's a spectrum, Christian nationalism at one end, 2K, R2K at the other end, the report is toward the R2K side. That's the way I heard you talking. You didn't say that explicitly, but that's the feeling I got.
Let's enter there for a second. And so my position is I actually thought the report was really good. And I really had maybe three issues that I wanted them to clean up on it. But, you know, and a number of the tweets, and I think you actually were responding in some of them, was me saying I thought it kind of was a clearly not a rejection of modern Two Kingdom theology, but definitely challenged it at many points. And I thought it was very open to a lot of things that are being called Christian nationalism, while drawing a hard line on if you are a PCA minister, because this is a PCA report, who subscribes in your mind to the 1646 original standards, then you need to declare a difference with 1788. And I agree with that partially. There are some places where clearly there's a distinction, but all the areas it was saying were in conflict. It even acknowledged that there's a debate about whether they're actually in conflict. So that was my issue, was more in how it handled 1646 to 1788. But in general, I thought it was very favorable to, again, a lot of what's being called Christian nationalism, minus all the ethnocentric race stuff, which you knew it was going to condemn. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I think since I'm on the study committee for the OPC, and thankfully we have two different committees, one on ethno kinship issues. I'm pretty sure we did that. And we have Christian nationalism, which is separate. And, you know, I think, I have no idea what we will do, although I do think my sense is that this isn't a subscription kind of issue for the OPC, which is unusual in a way, because we're usually fairly strict, seemingly compared to the PCA, with the full faith subscription that PCA has been using for 15 years or more. So I was kind of surprised to see subscription come into play in the PCA report. And again, I don't know that it really will go there for the OPC.
Yeah. Well, you guys, I mean, are you allowed to declare, like, receive exceptions, or are you just basically?
No, that's not part of our, we just generally let presbyteries decide whether somebody qualified or not. And after theological exams, I mean, somebody may state differences, but we don't grant exceptions. We don't grant, okay, you can't teach that sort of thing. That's not the way we've operated.
Yeah, but you have to do say you do have to say where you differ, right? Or maybe not you as an elder, but a pastor has to say if they have any differences. They don't even.
Well, I mean, I think they, if it comes up, they will have to explain it. And then, of course, Presbytery will decide whether that's a person overall that can be ordained or not with that view. But again, we don't have the policy or practice of granting exceptions. And these are things you can teach, even though they're outside the confession. We just haven't
Well,
handled it that way.
yeah, we should be handling it that way. It's anyway, that's another discussion. So what I find interesting about like the NAEPARC world, particularly some of the PCA, the ARP, RPCNA, and the OPC, is basically we are all going to have a different position on church-state relations. Because I don't want to say your report's a foregone conclusion, but between you, David Van Drunen, who I've read, I'm very aware of your views, and Dr. Strange, it's going to, I think, be much less sympathetic to anything that sniffs of Christian nationalism, where I thought the PCA report was very open to it. So I think it's just interesting. It's interesting that we
Right.
have this fellowship in NAEPARC and yet such a disagreement and difference over this stuff.
Well, where do you think the report is open to it? I mean, I'm thinking especially the five positions at the end, the general influence, the nursing father position, the establishment position. Theonomy, and then the ethno, the kinist position.
Well,
And
clearly the kinist position is out of bounds, and
right.
what it's, I think it conflates the 1646 standards with an establishment position. I think there's a new view of establishment that you hear guys talking about that doesn't adopt 1646 as their thing. So when it does say, it condemns and or not condemns, but it says establishment position is not allowed by 1788. I don't think it's dealing with the latest views, but I mean, there's statements all throughout the report that basically say these views are not heterodox, they're not subpar Christian. It just basically says we in the PCA have adopted the 1788, and so we need to be honest about that. And between you and me, I'd love to know what you think I believe about this. Like
Oh,
what do you think
well,
after listening?
I
Go
took
ahead.
some notes.
Yeah.
You wrote a piece beginning of this year. You gave a definition. January 2026, you wrote a piece after interviewing several different people, among them myself, a definition of Christian nationalism. The best you could do was a Christian national identity and heritage. That was one point. Second point was Christian government, that is Christian leaders and laws. Third point was national actions that assume, celebrate, and promote Christianity. That was the third. The fourth was Christian national institutions in which Christianity is normative, assumed, and foundational. And then the fifth and last point was restrictions on non-Christian religions, such that they are not promoted or given equal rights of expression and proselytization, same rights as Christianity. So I put you down, George, under the Christian national identity and heritage. I put both of us down as saying no to that. When it came to Christian government, I put, that is, Christian leaders in government, I put you down as preferable and me down as unnecessary. Then when it comes to national actions that assume Christianity and celebrate it, I put you down as saying yes, and I put myself down as saying sometimes. And then when it comes to Christian national institutions in which Christianity is normative, I put you down as saying yes, mainly, but not always, but mainly. And I come down as saying no to that. And then restrictions on non-Christian religions, I put you down as saying preferable. That may be unfair, but still, I put you down as preferable, and I would say no.
Yeah, that's, I like the way you did that. So, would you call me a Christian nationalist?
No, I would say you're Christian nationalist attracted.
You've been talking to Brad too much. okay. So my view, I think, is very similar to Miles Smith, as much as I can pin him down. I think he's been a little slippery on this, depending on who he's talking to, and maybe he's having a progression. And in saying that, I'm not saying he's being dishonest. I think he's being very honest. I think he just has a very complicated view. But basically, I think, yes, I think, first of all, Christians, a society founded by Christians, I believe, can have all those things in that list. I don't see why we would say a society made up of Christians, founded by Christians, is not allowed to do those things. Mm-hmm. So now, where are we today? We're not there, you know? And so the question is, how much should Christians be working toward that? And I think Romans 13 plays into it. I don't think we as the church ought to be subverting our governmental structure. I do think we are a pluralistic, liberal society, and I would prefer if we were in a society where maybe we were more Christian publicly, but that's not where we are. And so my position has not been to advocate to advance Christian nationalist causes. My position has been the views within NAPARC are allowable, and wherever aberrant and sinful views have showed up in NAPARC, they've been dealt with without all these committees and reports. And so every time, you know, a pastor in one of our denominations gets defrocked or excommunicated, people say, see, it's a problem. And I'm saying, yes, sin is always a problem. And every time this one comes up, it's been dealt with in the ARP, in the RPCNA, in the OPC, in the PCA. And so trying to develop some kind of a litmus test around what a person believes around church-state relations, I think is, I just don't think it's wise, given our history and heritage and Reformed Presbyterian stuff. So my position at times, I had people from my old church say, hey, these people are here, they listen to your podcast, they didn't know we, you know, you were a pastor, they love you, they say you're a Christian nationalist. I at times I am defending Christian nationalists because I believe their views are in bounds, in as much as they are in the boundaries even that our report lays out. Does that make sense, or is it helpful? Yeah.
I think it does, but I mean, what if, and I don't know if I said this to you before or not, but, and I may have said it on Twitter in some of our exchanges, but what if I thought, and we would agree with this, that government is going poorly in the United States right now, that we're just not getting good government. I mean, Florida, you're in Florida, Governor DeSantis gets a lot of good press, at least in the conservative world. And so Florida may be sort of an exception. But otherwise, generally speaking, it's hard for governments to actually do what they're supposed to do, irrespective of religion. Just, you know, catching the dogs, taking the trash, filling the potholes, convicting the criminals, etc. So, I mean, I think we probably both agree that government is going badly in the United States, but I don't think Christianity is the solution I think Christian nationalists think Christianity is the solution. And I think you're somewhat attracted to that, even though you may not be all the way there.
Yeah, so I agree. Government, and that's, you know, some of the, you know, you joke about the post-war consensus, the discussion of how we ended up here and what's going on in our country. I think Christian nationalists get, I guess I won't say a bad rap, but they get kind of tarred with trying to impose Christianity through government as if that's going to increase or grow the kingdom of God. That's not what I hear the mainstream of them saying. I think what they're saying is foundationally, we have an understanding of the nature of reality, the human heart, and we actually know truth. And so why are we pretending we don't know these things? These are the things that helped found our society, and we want to go back to those presuppositional level things so we can get back to some semblance of order so that we're not mutilating children and doing all these other weird things that under the guise of like, this is equal rights or this is what it is in pluralism or whatever. And so I think it's trying to be a return to normalcy in some sense, not trying to, you know, I've never heard a Christian nationalist say they're going to win people the gospel through governmental power. It's just simply, we need boundaries for society. And how does a society operate? And you can't divorce those, that level of things from actual what you believe about truth.
Right. But I mean, and again, I share, I'm sure, most, if not all of your concerns about family, sex, marriage issues that have been very prominent in the last 10 years. But I think Presbyterians, Protestants, share those convictions with Roman Catholics, Muslims, Jews, and Mormons. And it's not merely, you know, I mean, the Christian nationalists use Christianity a lot. I think they really mean Protestant. And I also think they really mean Reformed Protestant. And they allow Baptists in the fold on that one.
Okay. And a lot of them are co-laboring with Catholics in the cause, like Joel Webbin and others. But you're right, it is Protestant.
And I just don't know what Christianity gives you that some kind of theistic alliance wouldn't give you, or a natural law sort of alliance, even though I know natural law is really hard to define and use, etc. But I do think that politically, Christian nationalism just can't get much traction in a democratic society. And I think forming alliances with other people of like mind is really important. And what you call that, back in the day, we called it the moral majority, or we called it the religious right. But I mean, I just think, I don't, I mean, just for branding's sake, I'm not sure how well Christian nationalism is going to do, irrespective. And this has come up recently on Twitter, and I'm surprised it didn't come up earlier. What is a definition of nationalism? I mean, right. It's a very long definition that has a history all of its own. Miles, I know, has been tweeting about it lately, that chances are Stephen Wolfe doesn't mean what Mazzini, I can't remember his first name, is probably Giuseppe, an Italian romantic nationalist from the 19th century, means by it. And that's very different from what Jesus would have meant by nation in the Great Commission, or what Luke might have meant by nation in Acts 2 at Pentecost. You know, so that's a whole different proposition. And, you know, after, talk about a pre-war consensus, National Socialism and the kind of nationalism that was around then, it's another reason why you may not want to use Christian nationalists as a badge to define your movement.
Right.
I'm not you specifically, but people who are using it.
No, I understand. And I just happen to have, I'm going through this now. And people are like, well, why are you reading that? I'm like, because I want to know what the guys wrote. Mm-hmm. Wolf actually addresses that nationalism thing, what it meant, what he means in the first chapter there. But I do agree with that. And as a pastor of a church, which I was in an elder before that for years, I would warn of like where our true citizenship is. And I haven't changed my views on that. But I do think we've all acknowledged that this is, the whole thing is a reaction to, it's kind of like the pendulum goes from one side to the other. And, the quote angry young men is thrown about in this. I think that's dismissive of, people are observing real problems that we are having in how the nature of reality is viewed. And we're saying, they're saying, maybe there's a better way. But I mean, I again, that's not, Christian national. I've never referred to myself as that. I kind of want to get past it. I just, my thing is, I want us to all just get along. We understand what the boundaries are. I think, as I've said, I believe, the modern Two Kingdom movement all the way up to, I believe establishmentarians are within, like, you can believe that. I don't know why a person can't believe that a nation, when every nation has typically had some religion established in their nation in the whole history of the world, that we come along in America and basically say, no, you can't have an established religion. And by the way, I'm not advocating for one. I'm just saying, like, when I think of the standards, and this is another issue I have with our report, like, these are, and our report even says that this is what we believe the Bible teaches about the doctrines that we believe. Doctrines we believe don't change with people, place, and time. And yet here we are debating, like, chapter 23's view of the magistrate, and it seems to be a view that, like, America has changed that view, like, or that view was changed, or America's the product of the change in that view. And that's why I think, to say, like, I accept the American revisions to the standards as the bare bones basic concept of what the magistrate's duties are, particularly for our context. But I can't say that the magistrate can't have more duties in other places, And so I guess I'm kind of rambling now.
Well, I mean, what has come up, and it was there in, and we could talk about the larger catechism too. I have some thoughts about that, but explicitly in chapter 23, that the language of suppression, last time I checked, is gone. That suppressing false religion in the 1788 revisions is gone. It's much more of a nursing father, and the idea of promoting piety, whatever that might mean. But this is why I also think.
So the suppression of heresies, that's what you mean?
Yeah.
And abuses in worship.
And that's gone.
Right. Yep.
And what I've been surprised by from the Christian nationalists, and again, this is why I think you may be adjacent, because I put you as on that definition I gave, restrictions on non-Christian religions, such that they're not promoted or given equal rights as Christianity. I put you down as preferable, and I put myself down as no. But irrespective of where you come down on that, George, I find it amazing. I mean, just remarkable. And not in a positive way, but I don't want to sound like I'm clutching pearls, that younger men in reform circles are embracing suppression of religion as a positive good by government when, beginning of the 16th century, you think about French Protestants having to figure out what to do with a tyrannical king when it came to practicing their religion. Same thing under Roman Catholic monarchs sometimes in England, that eventually what Protestants learned was, we want to take that power away from the magistrate and have a freedom of religion and religious liberty being the norm for society, and that is going to be conducive for the church. The church will be best served in a liberal or religiously free society. That even is something I think that Schaeffer and Jerry Falwell would have promoted in the late 70s, early 80s. But now there's a real, it's a post-liberal time, I get that. There are questions about the post-World War II consensus and whatnot. But still, I can't imagine why people would think giving government power over religious expression could in any way be a good thing, especially after what churches endured during COVID. That was a clear mistake that should never come back.
Yeah, and I think... Just, I'm going to answer your question and your specific points there. But I think one thing I appreciate that you said that I think gets lost in the R2K debate and kind of attacks against you guys is it's not that you're disinterested religiously or spiritually. That what you said, there's an argument to be made, and you guys firmly believe this, that the church is actually best protected when the government stays out of religion. It's actually a protection for the church and for the purity of the church. I know you guys are very concerned about, you know, what type of Christian prince Christian nationalists will get. And we see in the White House, you see Paula White is like the main advisor there. And I don't think any of us would like that influence. So I'm sympathetic to that, but to the point about, Christianity is privileged and other religions aren't, to that kind of taxonomy I had there or whatever. My point in saying that is, I agree with it to a point. First of all, I believe people should be able to worship however their conscience leads them to, and that's a reform principle, even if that's false worship. But I don't think a government founded by Christians has to pretend that false worship is real worship. Now, we're not there, and I'm not advocating that for our country right now, but my point in saying that is it totally seems to me that in the founding of this country, they could have not forbidden Jews to worship in synagogues. As a matter of fact, you know, Washington's famous letter to synagogues and stuff, but that those religions, Islam, Hindu religions, they're allowed to operate and exist, but we're not going to allow them public national expressions. And, you know, this would play out in allowing the monuments, you know, giant Hindu statues, just because, you know, whatever their Hindu temple owns the land, they can just put whatever they want on it. I mean, it seems to me like there's all kinds of governmental codes preventing things. Like, why couldn't, but we stop and saying, well, when it comes to religion, we can't do that. And so I'm not actually advocating, I don't think, anything for current America, but I'm saying historically, I don't see why a nation couldn't prohibit those things.
Hmm.
Well, you know, the typical examples of the five calls to prayer in Dearborn, Michigan, like, and I remember even Miles was like, yeah, if they want to do that, they can do that. But if, you know, the citizens don't want to allow it, they don't. So there's no necessary right to it. The society could determine. Now, I'm saying a Christian society could say, no, we're not going to have that thing going off five times a day, but we're not going to ban church bells. I think that's within the purview of government. I do. That doesn't mean that the government can prevent people from assembling and worshiping.
I mean, I guess I think it would be hard for any government in the United States, the way the courts have gone and read the Bill of Rights, the First Amendment especially, into local and state contexts, for anyone to prohibit religious expression. The calls to prayer, I mean, I've been in Turkey twice, and I actually think it's a kind of a amazing experience to arrive late in the afternoon, have dinner, go to bed, and around 10 o'clock you hear a call to prayer echoing throughout the city of Istanbul, because that's one of the designated hours. And it's kind of weird. Just as I think, Jews might think it's weird in the United States for a month at least to go into any 7-Eleven or a convenience store and hear some sort of Christian carol or Christian song, many of those Christian songs written by Jewish Americans, no less. But I don't want to see government micromanage that sort of thing. I mean, neighborhood I used to live in Philadelphia, they were beginning to put in pickleball courts where the tennis courts were, and many of the neighbors around the courts were protesting because of the sound of the pocking, I guess, of the rackets in pickleball as opposed to tennis. It makes more noise. And I could see people in Dearborn saying, well, at certain hours we want the volume turned way down on that, because this is a public airwaves, this is public sound, and respecting the good order of the place, we're going to do that. But I wouldn't argue for that on religious grounds. And when it comes to monuments, if a local county or city wants to put up a monument to some non-Christian religion, I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily go out of my way to support it or to look at it. On the other hand, you go to any major city in the United States, and there are these huge Mormon temples that are on private land, and they're acknowledging the Mormon faith in some way. And in my most devout moments, I would prefer not to think that people are Mormon and worshiping there and taking encouragement from that. But on the other hand, it's the United States of America. What can I do?
Well, exactly. To what you just said, this is America, and so we like. And to me, this might be a Romans 13 thing where we're respecting this is what we are. But I'm saying my point is just because this is what America is and is doing and allows doesn't make that moral law for the globe for all space and time. So I don't. I think it's fine for Turkey to have the thing going off. They're a Muslim place, but it's weird to say, but we're not gonna allow that, that sort of a identity to exist in this country now today, where we're only really 30% Christian, I think. We're not that anymore, But to the point about government controlling expressions of religion, I mean, the government already does that. Mormons can't have polygamy, and Muslims can't, forgive the graphic thing, but they can't circumcise their girls. There's already limits that we agree with that the government can do against other religions, and the only reason for that is because in Christianity we have a different understanding.
But I mean, I think those decisions about Mormon marriage and about other practices. I mean, even without getting into Islamic circumcision rites, even Jews in America would have to, I can't remember what the man who performs the circumcisions is
A
called,
moil,
the moil.
moil.
Thank you. I'm sure you'd have to be certified that the government is going to have restrictions for public health grounds. It's not because we're Christian. Now, you can perhaps see echoes of our Christian past, our Protestant past, in those kinds of policies, partly because the people who that get to a society first wind up defining it in ways that everybody who comes later is going to have to adjust to in a certain way. But I still think that the reasons for that are not religious and more secular, to use that fraught word.
But what is the secular argument against polygamy? There are people that want, there are non-Mormons who want this now. I mean, it was just a court case recently about it, I think.
I mean, you know what it's like to be married to one woman. Try being married to
Yeah, but I know, that's the joke, right? We have but
Sorry,
like you,
that was a little bit of a
yeah. Or and just to add to it, Daryl, like I remember with R. Scott Clark, this could be over a year ago, and he probably, I guarantee he doesn't remember it, but there was some video about some woman talking about plastic surgery that, you know, we have the technology to suck out fat from our bodies. We have the technology to, you know, to, if I wanted, I can get rid of my Arab nose. I don't. But also plastic surgery that allows us to, you know, heal burn victims and help women with double mastectomies and all kinds of things that are beneficial uses of plastic surgery. So, you know, this is through nature, we're able to use technology and medical science and biology to do these things to the human body. What's the limit then that prevents from natural law somebody going through a sex change operation? What's the natural law argument from a man be, you know, becoming a woman or a woman becoming a man when we have the technology to do that?
Well, I mean, I think I'd want to hear from the experts about adults doing it. And as much as I personally think it's kind of grotesque to think about mutilating the body that way, but if you want to give people freedom to live their lives as they can, and you and adults choose to do this fully informed about the consequences of it, I can live with that. I mean, what I think has driven the recent debates about trans has been not merely what's happening in sports, but also what's happening to kids and a contagion of adolescent kids, especially girls, who have been attracted to this and making decisions, perhaps, and who knows what their parents are thinking and kind of giving them guidance. But you know, I could say putting an age limit on it and say you've got to be a certain age before you can decide this. And those are all kind of maybe not natural law, but more common sense reasons for it.
Well, not, common sense is natural law, but I mean, we don't allow people to do drugs. Now, certain drugs are becoming allowed. My point is, in society, we do limit adverse behaviors due to the effects those things have, not on society. And there's always the tension between individual rights of freedom and how it impacts the rest of society. And without a moral compass, a common understanding of the nature of reality, basically it's we're in the book of Judges. And what I'm saying is a Christian people, which we are not, can establish We know these truths from Scripture, and this is how we're going to govern our society, whether you want to do these things or not. We're not going to let you. Now, we're not there, but my whole argument is we that is allowable in government. And I think this gets to the heart of maybe the different, like, philosophical difference between what we're calling M2K, Modern Two Kingdom, which is you know R2K is often used, is like, my understanding is you guys believe it's actually not simply like not wise, but it's would be biblically wrong to impose a Christian worldview upon the civil sphere, that those spheres have to operate neutrally by natural law. Is that an accurate statement? Like, it's not just prudence. Like, you believe it's wrong for the Christian, like, for Christianity to be expressed in government. And I don't mean like somebody saying God bless America or something.
I'm not sure I'd go that far, because.
Okay.
I mean, I know historically that it has happened, and I, you know, I don't want to judge John Calvin as a sinner because of his views about the magistrate and the magistrate promoting Christianity. I would say he's wrong. He's in error.
Biblically? Biblically?
Well, I would say he's going, he doesn't have biblical warrant for it.
Okay. So it's more than just prudence for you. It's right. there's a, and this is my point. The R2K Modern Two Kingdom view is, this is actually, like you said, an error biblically. It's not just that wasn't prudent. He should have done it differently.
I would say the Bible, New Testament doesn't give many insights about government. And where we do get it, we see descriptions of by Peter, Paul, and Jesus of what the magistrate's responsibilities are, and they're describing either pagan emperors, pagan governors, or Pharisaical Jewish leaders. None of those we would want as ideal magistrates. So for that reason, I don't think the New Testament prescribes government in any way, which is why people go to the Old Testament so much, and why theonomy has a kind of shelf life that it does, because you can find in the Old Testament examples of not very good ones, but examples of believing monarchs, at least, or believing governments. But you know, I do think that, you know, the major breakthrough in the history of Christianity is the conversion of Constantine and the Roman Empire becoming Christian very briefly in the West. It doesn't take, and Byzantium in the East becomes that Christian society. And that's a kind of also very delicate society. I don't know how many Christian nationalists are pining for the days of Byzantium. But the Bible itself, you know, doesn't give us the guidance, but the Bible doesn't prescribe a lot of what I do in my life. So I have freedom. And so I think Christian nationalists may have freedom to advocate, not merely because we live in the United States, but even freedom as Christians to advocate or for a certain view. But they also have to square it at some point with saying, the Bible doesn't necessarily support this, and therefore the argument that I'm making isn't necessarily a Christian argument. It's informed by Christianity, but it's my argument. It's my opinion. It's theologically informed, what I think is right for government to do, but I can't require it of other Christians because the Bible doesn't require.
Okay. That sounds different than, and you're not speaking for all of, you know, the spectrum of Modern Two Kingdom views.
Right.
And you're, you know, you're a historian also. You know, some things that came to mind as you're saying that is like, well, slavery. I mean, there's no mandate to abolish slavery. I know there's laws against man-stealing and such. But we would say the abolition of slavery was the good and necessary consequence of Christians in society having the ability to do such a thing. I think that's the argument.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds to me...
non-Christians too. And a lot of liberal Christians who supported it. Many more liberal than Orthodox. Because again, the Bible doesn't lead you to an abolitionist position, I would argue. It does lead you to cutting it off in certain ways and restraining it and reforming it. But, you know, a radical abolitionist position, no slavery, it's really hard to find that in Scripture.
Right, right. But we would all agree it's a good thing. I mean, I hope to have abolished it. Okay. So would you say, biblically speaking, now, again, we can't point to a verse or whatever, but your understanding of a biblical theology of this, of the Scriptures, that a pluralistic, and you can correct and cut and paste whatever, you know, words you want, that a pluralistic liberal society is what the Bible anticipates as the ideal society in the fall?
I wouldn't say ideal. I take out the word ideal. I think living in a fallen society, you're trying to make do with the best you can out of a really bad set of conditions. And therefore, whenever we can get a modicum of order and stability and peace, woohoo. But, I mean, some of the people who've written about Augustine, and Augustine gets used all sorts of different ways, and Augustine in some ways isn't relevant because he's how many, almost two millennia from us, and he's living at the end of the Roman Empire. But one of the guys I like a lot who writes about Augustine and Augustine's reception in the Middle Ages, Francis Oakley, a medieval historian, Roman Catholic, but not a fan of papal supremacy. But he makes this point that basically government is like dog catching. You don't look to it for these grand ideals and for inspiration and for the ideal society. You look sort of just basically kind of muck around and keep things as orderly as possible. And that's what, I mean, that is really the way I view government and society. And I do find it a little odd for people to be talking so extravagantly, positively about government and what government can do, especially when it comes to religion.
Okay. So doesn't Romans 13, so for you, government is mainly a defensive thing.
Right.
Okay. Does Romans 13 say it's there to promote the good, to punish the evil, promote the good?
Right.
I have to look. Okay. So promoting the good suggests an ordering toward the good. So it's more than defense. There's a proactive thing going on there.
Conceivably, or it could just mean you don't punish people who are good. You don't punish them for doing good. You punish the wicked. And you say, good job to those people, but let it go at that.
Well, that's promotion. Okay, so right. let me see if I can define the Modern Two Kingdom, what is online as R2K. And, you know, I think even R. Scott Clark, you know, will concede the R2K moniker. For him, it's not radical, it's reformed. He has a whole piece on this on his Heidel blog. But basically, tell me where I go wrong in my understanding, and maybe there's a spectrum there too. But basically, there's two main kingdoms, the spiritual kingdom and the natural kingdom. The spiritual kingdom is the church, the natural kingdom is the world and the nations of the world. In a Kuiperian sense, there's different spheres. The Noahic covenant is a common grace covenant. that God will preserve the world for all people, not just for the church. And again, I know two kingdoms isn't typically viewed as Kuyperian, but Kuyperian would say that Kuyper would say that's toward that preservation of the world is to the ends of the covenant community, because that's the where the Christians are coming from. But at any rate, the establishment of government happens there with, you know, for if a man takes a life shall be required, and that sort of establishes government. So the governing of the church is governed by special revelation, revealed law, and saving grace, where the governing of nations is governed by general revelation, natural law, and common grace. And David Van Drunen, who, you know, I'm not asking you to speak for him, but I think he summarizes it as basically governments are there to govern between intra-human affairs. So not the vertical between man and God, but between man and man.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, that's why it's the second table of the law. The government is not interested or get involved in the first table of the law. And therefore, in all this, to inject Christianity into government through laws and rituals would be to bind people's consciences and go beyond what government is there to do. Did I say anything? And I know, I mean, you don't have it in front of you, but like, did that right. basically represent the position? And what did I miss?
No, that does. I think that I might, I don't know what I would add if I were reading it. I might add something, but I think that's a fair summary of I mean, I've read Dave a lot. I read Scott less so, but I've also read Scott, and I tend to agree with them.
Okay.
On this.
So let's go to the moral law. So this is where I think the modern two kingdom position is a departure from our confession on this.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't say that with any, I don't say that pejoratively. I don't say that these guys are out of bounds or anything like that. But our confession says that the moral law is summarized in the Ten Commandments. And so when these guys talk about, well, the moral law, and then they restrict it to the second table of the law, really it's further restricted beyond that, because it's not even the second table of the law that's they're allowing government to deal with, because it's essentially don't steal, don't murder. It's property rights and right to life. I mean, nothing around adultery is dealt with, or anything a confession says about all those commandments. Do you understand what I'm saying about how the more, like our confession defines the moral law as the Ten Commandments, or the Ten Commandments are an expression of
right,
that.
Right.
But when these guys say moral law and to that natural law, they're really not talking about the Ten Commandments.
Well, I mean, I'm not trying to.
You don't have to speak for them. Just
no. I mean, I guess one thing I'd say is that a magistrate, especially in a religiously diverse society, will have to pay attention to the first table, in the sense of, okay, I have all these different people with different convictions about worship, God, whether there are more gods than one, holy days and whatnot. And I'm going to have to navigate that as a magistrate. So I'm going to pay attention to that part of the moral law and the ways that all these religious groups come at the moral law. I'm not necessarily going to come down just as, I mean, I don't think the I mean, Roman Catholics may actually think our government does come down on marriage in a Protestant way that's not Roman Catholic, because the United States looks at marriage as a civil act and not as a sacramental act. You know, even there, when you get to the second table, you get into different questions about the way religious groups interpret this. So I'm comfortable with the magistrate thinking about the moral law and the expression of it in the Ten Commandments. And I think Hindus probably have an expression of the moral law. I think Jews clearly do. Roman Catholics do. And now I got to watch out as a magistrate how I navigate those different claims. And when it comes up, in public life, what do I do about it?
Yeah. Okay. Just checking on your time. Are you good on time? Could we
Yeah, I should
keep
probably
going?
maybe go 10 more minutes or so and.
Okay. All right. So here I have, like, I think you had said to me, either online or privately, that that the report, like, I jokingly tweeted like how the report was a condemnation of R2K, and or at least challenged a lot of R2K assumptions, and you had taken issue with that. And so here's some questions that I want to see how you would answer. Is the in an R2K framework, is the magistrate granted latitude? I'm not talking about America. I'm just saying, in an R2K, is the magistrate granted latitude regarding his posture toward false religion?
Say that again. I just want to make sure I understand it, George. Sorry.
Yeah, and that might be a vague question.
No, but no, that I'm
Is the
not.
mag yeah is the magistrate allowed biblically some latitude regarding his posture toward false religion in his role as magistrate, or must he allow it? I'll add that point. So is there latitude for him in dealing with it, or he has to just allow it?
No, I think there's latitude, especially concerning public order and peace and stability. And I mean, one example that came
That's
up
a great thing.
with Michael Bowman and the Restless Guys podcast about he tweeted something about Satanism. And I think I said something like that's a little clickbaity. And the example was the Iowa State House where there was a Satan exhibit. And you know, I it for me it's like the drag queen story hour. What are librarians thinking doing that? If you want to support drag queens in some way or Satanists in some way, don't use public institutions like that. Unless that you have actually surveyed your people and think that everyone in your community is, or most people are okay with this. Otherwise, you're just being inflammatory, and that's not good. We have a lot of that going on in public life right now, which is unfortunate, but I just don't think that's very good. So the re you know, what I would say is a magistrate should use common sense and also have a good sense of what the public opinion is in his or her constituency and what that public opinion will bear. And I still think it'd be very hard to find public opinion way up on on drag queen story hour or way up on say even I mean you get even less support for satanic expressions, I'm sure.
So, but for you, it always comes back to, and I get that because government is about civil order, but what society will allow. And I suppose the opposite is true, that if we're going to ban the satanic display, we have to ban all religious, the Christian display. Now, I'm not advocating for nativity scenes and all that, but just there's ways of maybe acknowledging Christianity that would need to be banned. If you're going to ban drag queen story hour in a library, then you need to ban, Bible reading to kids in the library. And like there's everything becomes a level playing field, as opposed to an actual preference. But the reason I ask that is the report acknowledges that the magistrate has latitude regarding his posture toward false religion in his role as a magistrate.
And I would
Should
agree with that, yeah.
okay. Should the church be countenanced and maintained by the civil magistrate? Of course, this is Westminster Larger Catechism 191. But it isn't, it's the report affirms that.
Right. I mean, you know, I don't know what the if any of the supplemental reports or appendices to the report will bring up the tax status of churches and charitable status. I mean, that is a kind of break that clergy and congregations receive in the United States. that we don't have to pay taxes on our property. And yeah, I don't know how it works for pastors and how you guys pay your taxes or don't pay your taxes. And I could see people in the United States who are hostile to Christianity thinking that that's an unfair advantage for churches.
So synagogues don't get tax break on their property?
No, I'm sure they do. I mean,
Yeah.
so then the question would become, how wide is that sphere of, tax breaks that goes to all sorts of charitable institutions? It's not just churches that are there. There are other nonprofits that are also in that group. And I don't know, for instance, whether Satanists qualify. If there's a Satanist temple or whatever they call it, coven, I don't know. I have no idea. But if they have property, do they get a tax break?
Yeah, I
Probably
don't
they
know. I mean,
do.
yeah. I mean,
But
we kind of saw this with, Hegseth and the Department of War or whatever in their chaplain designation, and they boiled all the religions
right.
down, and then the Mormons got upset because they weren't described as a Christian denomination, but Seventh-day Adventists were. And so, like, you do see how the government gets into a mess when it tries to define things religiously. And so some say, well, that means government needs to be out of that. But my point is, well, government can do that. I'm not saying it's wise in our context, but okay. So does R2K, Modern Two Kingdom, believe that 1646 standards teaches a view that is contrary to the Christian faith?
I wouldn't say that.
Okay,
I
so it's
would
not con it's
say
not
it's
go ahead.
unwise, but I would say it's not anti-Christian.
Okay. Well, I wonder what other guys would say. So you do not believe that a person who holds a 1646 is unorthodox then, or
No.
heterodox. Okay. Does R2K believe that those who argue that civil government should govern in light of revealed law, is that in line with confessional orthodoxy?
It has been.
How about currently?
I guess, I mean, I would say no, that is not the way to do it. And that's not way to the way to argue. But again, I mean, I do think that acknowledging July 4th, 250th and all that, freedom of religion. And I've really become more patriotic than I ever thought I was possible, having written about Independence Hall and the founders. But it's a free country, and Christian nationalists can make their arguments however they want. And God bless them, seriously. I mean, they can promote their views as much as they want, but you got to think about what's going to persuade people who aren't in your camp. What's going to bring them over? And I just don't think in a democratic society, if we don't want to have a democracy, that's fine. But since we do, how are you going to get more voters to take your position? That's sort of what you need. And I just, again, don't think it's a winning position.
Right. Yeah, so it always goes back to our context as
Right.
opposed to in, just what's allowed in.
And locally, like where you are in Florida, or even where James Baird is in Florida, maybe the city councils can do some of this, and at a certain level. And that's fine. I'm really a pluralist when it comes to that, and I think I'm also a localist, and I think local government should do more and not depend on the federal government.
No. Let me go through a few more of these. Does in the modern Two Kingdom view, does it believe that views regarding establishment strike at the vitals of religion?
Well, only in the sense of, I don't know if freedom of conscience qualifies as the vitals of religion, but establishment does. I know I've read the guys and say they're not trying, they believe in freedom of conscience. It's only practice that they're trying to restrict or advocating restrictions on. But I do think that establishment has implications for freedom of conscience that I think we should be very careful about. But whether that's a vital of religion, I mean, I do think conscience is pretty important.
Yes.
And therefore, I would at least want to have a lot of reservations implied in a pro-establishment position that makes room for freedom of conscience.
Yeah. I don't need to go through all these, but I have over a dozen places that I've seen, and I'm not you. I mean, I know you, I posted something once and you're like, name names, George, like, the online battles. We want name. Like, I don't know if you thought I was referring to you. I wasn't. But the idea that quite frankly, a lot of these people, if they want to see Christianity reflected in our government, again, not in Miles Smith terms, not in a churchly sense, but just like the facts of it, the presuppositions of it. It's called glory theology. It's called rejecting a theology of the cross. It's called a compromise of the gospel. Quite frankly, I see that all the time. And what I'm saying is these 12 quotes that I have affirm these things, that the people who believe these things are not outside of Christianity. They're not necessarily compromising the gospel, just like anything we create an idol of is a compromise of the gospel. So that it's how you hold these views. And so I've often associated a posture toward people like from the modern Two Kingdom camp, a posture toward people who don't agree with those governmental arrangements as subpar Christians. And so while I believe people can believe in this sort of what I'll call a hard separation of church and state in a modern Two Kingdom sense, it always seems to come with those who don't agree with that being considered, like, again, subpar or not having a good enough understanding of the gospel. And that's why I was saying this is just as challenging against a modern Two Kingdom view of things as it is a hard establishment view of things.
Right. I mean, I think where there may be, maybe you have me in view a little bit is the it's not so much a compromise of the gospel, but is it a compromise of the church? And with all the attention about Christian government, Christian princes that Christian nationalists are now raising, have we lost confidence in the church and the church as the institution that advances the kingdom of our Lord Jesus Christ and not the government? I mean, I think the standards are clear about that, that it's the church that is called to do that. The state has a different role. The state, you can't necessarily do the church, be the church without some kind of help from the state, whether it's protecting people from hurting the church or whatever. So, it's not as if you can just live with one and not the other. But I do worry, I guess, that all the talk about government has, we've lost attention to what the church does and the uniqueness of the church, the supremacy of the church, and the really great glory of the church as this is the, these are the means by which Christ is bringing people to himself.
Amen. And the report says that in a number of places.
Right.
No, I know you don't seem to believe that I didn't have you in mind. I'll tell you offline who I had in mind. But I do, because I kind of think you're a troll online. I don't know what to.
Sure, of
You
course.
seem you in person and in your writings, you seem more reasonable than you are online. So I just take it for what it is online. I mean, I even appreciated your latest interview with was it Sola Media with and Miles was on it.
Right.
And I thought you even reflected Stephen Wolf respectfully in that. You referenced him and you reflected what his view is, or him as a philosopher or something. So I think there's the online demeanor and then there's the more serious stuff. But one thing you do kind of point out regularly about this church thing that you're saying, or at least related to it, is they want to do, like a typical tweet would be, they want to do this without the church, without the church. Like, and so when guys want to affirm the Two Kingdom paradigm, because Two Kingdom is a reformed thing, And they're saying, no, we're not asking the institutional church to do this. We as Christians are pursuing this. You somehow take objection to the church not being involved. Now, it's a catch-22. You don't want the church involved. And so when they say, well, we're not involving the church, then you're taking issue with, and how could you do it in the first place? What, explain that.
Well, how do you have a Christian magistrate who is not a member of a church, who hasn't been vetted in some way, his faith or her faith and profession have been vetted by a church body? And therefore, I mean, we don't believe, as Presbyterians, we don't believe you that in Christian faith that isn't part of the body of Christ. So if you're advocating for a Christian magistrate, you, the church is there in that equation, even though you're saying it's not establishment, okay, but still, you get into a situation which happened in the Middle Ages where the church has to decide to do, decide what to do with a wayward emperor.
Right. Well, I mean, but
so
I mean,
you're going to be involved in that equation. By having a Christian magistrate, you are mingling church and state.
Well, but you. I mean, I really enjoyed listening to Still Protesting. I got it on. It was free. Why are you giving that away for free? Did you
Not
know that?
My decision.
Oh, man. On my drive to General Assembly, I said, let me see if Hart has any books on here. Because I have Audible and I pay for credit, so I'd be buying it. And it was like free. So I'm like, I'm definitely. I thought that was. No, I thought that was great. Man, now I forgot why I'm even bringing that up. Oh, so when you go on this whole section about Luther and, you know, the idea of vocation and calling, you know, he acknowledges, of course, you can have a Christian magistrate. If you can't have a Christian magistrate, you can't have a Christian anything else. And if the magistrate can't bring his Christianity into his role, neither can it's, I think the example was like the cobbler can't sell shoes to a bishop or something like that. I don't know. This was Luther you were talking about. I thought it was fascinating. So, I mean, you don't deny there's an institutional church, and yet Christians as individuals are the church mobilized in the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I'm not sure. I still don't see what you're objecting to in, you know, yes, a Christian formally needs to be a member of a church, but in his duties in the world, he doesn't stop being a Christian in those duties.
But he does, at least the way I understand my own calling, when I'm a historian, when I'm a professor, when I was on the library board in Hillsdale, and I just recently got off the airport of advisory committee of all things, but I was there as a Christian in the sense that I'm trying to honor and glorify God, but I'm not thinking about the airport, I'm not thinking about the library, I'm not thinking about American history only as a Christian, or simply trying to go to the Bible to figure out how to do carry out these responsibilities, because I'm bringing in expertise that I have as a historian and knowledge that I've acquired by studying things that's independent. I mean, not maybe in a metaphysical way, but still, it's not in the Bible. And when I'm thinking about what's good for the airport in Hillsdale or for the local library in Hillsdale, I'm also having to think about, well, it's good for the people who are not Christians here as well. And so I have to put on a different cap in some way, even though the head is still a Christian head, but I'm wearing a different cap when I'm in those roles. And that's part of what, I mean, at the closing chapter of one of my other books, The Lost Soul of American Protestantism, I picked up on a phrase that another historian used to describe ethnicity in America. He called it hyphenated Americans. And I think of myself as a hyphenated Christian. where I'm a Christian American, I'm a Christian historian, I'm a Christian, but I have all these other dashes in my identity. I'm a Christian husband. Christian used to be a Christian son, my parents. Anyway, that's part of what I'm trying to get at. And it's not as if those things aren't under the lordship of Christ, but they're not guided by special revelation always, the way my life as a Christian, when I'm in church or serving in the courts of the church, are.
I understand what you're saying. I just think, we all process, it's the difference between how God deals with the world and how he deals with the church too. I mean, so we deal with the world and we deal with the church, but we're still processing it through a Christian lens. Anyway, was there anything else specifically you...
I'm sure there was, but we should do it again sometime. Maybe I can give you an update on our study committee at some point, maybe early next year or something, or there's breaking news we can always talk about more.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. That's sure. Great. I appreciate the access you give me and the friendship. So thanks, Daryl.
Sure. George, before we close, what do you have behind you?
This?
Where are you? Look like you're in a museum.
We moved into a new house, and I was so glad to finally get an office. But my son's home from college, so because we just moved in, I made it his bedroom. But as soon as he goes off, so this is like a den, and I have some. So that's a stand-up desk behind me.
Okay.
Of course, the Word of God's there. The Lord's Prayer is in that little plaque thing. That's Thor's hammer.
Oh wow!
And there's an eagle there. Talking about eagle's wings, but of course, that has to do with America. And he shall be called Jesus Christ in all the names of Christ. So
okay.
That's
okay.
Just,
all right.
Yeah.
That's okay.
My backdrop until I get in office.
I should go. I hear someone at the door.
Good deal. Well, good to talk to you. And thanks
to
for
you too,
everybody
George.
For
thanks.
Watching. Yeah. You're welcome. God bless.
Bye.
The training of the next generation of pastoral leaders is of vital importance. The problem is that seminary is oftentimes incredibly expensive. You have to uproot your family. You have to go to another place where you're not plugged into a local church. What BTS does is it provides a way for people to continue in their hometown, continue in their present ministry, gain the tools that they need for pastoral leadership, be equipped for the work of the ministry for the long haul, and do it inexpensively but substantively. I love that about Birmingham Theological Seminary.